Thank you, and thank you for the invitation to come up. I do appreciate it. As Gregory mentioned, I'm coming up from LA right now, so I think the best thing to do is just make this informal, so the questions as they come up, we can discuss as we go. Gregory mentioned giving a review of the field. When I started to look at reviewing the field, I realized that an hour was not going to be sufficient. So what I have done is go through a couple of review papers that I've been a co-author recently, try and extract some of the topics that we've been working on as a field and some of the key questions. And then I inserted a sort of second half that is my attempt or our attempt to answer some of those questions that have come up. So we'll go through sort of a couple of distinct pieces. Srini has a way with words, as you know, and he crafted this paragraph saying that, you know, the wall turbulence, we've sort of moved away from the idea that we're going to find the one idea that's going to solve everything. There are continually new problems that are coming to light, and one of the ones that I'm going to focus on here is the importance of the really long scales. So let me make a start. I'm going to focus on really on high Reynolds number boundary layers here. There's the majority of the theory and the simulations, of course, are at lower Reynolds numbers, or at least the DNS simulations. And what we're interested in really is getting to Reynolds numbers where we're approaching things of application interest, large things. So on the left here is the YAML Europe natural gas pipeline. Natural gas, and you can see the size of the pipeline here. And the Reynolds number there is a Reynolds number based on diameter and bulk velocity of the order of 10 to the 7, D plus. So, you know, the Kármán number, order of 10 to the 5. If you start to think about a 777, we're up at pretty high Reynolds number based on chord or length, length scale. And then I'm going to address some experiments in the near-neutral surface layer that we've used as a model for the highest terrestrially available Reynolds number. Now, of course, there'll be several problems associated with working in the surface layer and trying to relate that to a canonical boundary layer, and I'll address some of those. But you see that we're up at Reynolds numbers that are at least relevant to some of these applied flows. So for this group, I probably don't need to justify the study of wall turbulence as a fundamentally important problem, something of academic interest. I've cited here pipes, wings, and the boundary layer. One of the questions that will come up is how universal can we state any regions of these flows are going to be? And one of the findings, to sort of steal one of my punchlines, is that increasingly we're finding that the ideas of universality do not hold as well as we think had thought that they did. But that's another question we can answer. And then one sort of sideline here in terms of these industrial applications, there's been, you may be familiar with a controversy about the mean velocity scaling that originated maybe 10, 15 years ago. I'm not going to address that, except to say that that has really stimulated a lot more discussion and a lot more investigation of these high Reynolds number flows. If you believe in the log law, a classical one would be 0.41, one that was proposed associated with the first work from the Princeton Superpipe, and I'll address that facility a little later, came out as 0.436. The first point to make here is that I don't think anyone believes that third decimal place anymore. We know we just can't get the experimental measurements that accurately. But this sort of 5-6% change between these two numbers leads to a significant change in drag, so of the order of several drag count points. So it's significant, and this was Philippe Spillart's dismayed comment when he started to see these von Kármán constants changing. Understanding what happens at these very high Reynolds numbers, where we're really in a condition where we would hope to be able to extrapolate our findings, I mean, that's why the high Reynolds number regime is fundamentally interesting, will give us some input to some modeling efforts, simulation efforts, and then, of course, the sort of holy grail, if you like, is to be able to manipulate these flows, control them, get the flows to do what you want them to do, and in this at this time of environmental concerns, ideally to start to reduce fuel burn, that sort of thing. So that's a brief motivation. What I'm going to talk about today then is introduce, from my view, so of course everything comes with a rider, that this is my perspective on wall turbulence, introduction to the state of the art, some information about the statistical description, so sort of the traditional way of measuring, going back many decades, structural information, so there's been a lot of work thinking about the hairpin vortex paradigm, thinking about the near wall cycle, those sorts of things. And then another thing that's another sort of train of thought that's really become a lot stronger in the past decade or more is understanding the non-normality of the Navier-Stokes operator, linear analyses, transient growth. How does that link to what we see in a turbulent flow? I think there's been a lot of work that shows it's very important in a laminar flow, in transitional flow. The question is, how does that link to what we see in turbulence, or does it link? So I'm going to speak from these three papers listed here, pick out some topics. These are this edition of Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society was a collection of papers in the 2006-2007 frame of sort of current work. And there was a series of workshops organized by researchers in wall turbulence to try and frame the questions that we needed to be addressing. So some of these things related to how well could we determine the mean velocity scaling, you know, how accurate could we measure things, what measurements did we need to make to improve our understanding. This is an annual review, again, sort of state of the art, and this one is really outlining the key issues, so this is outstanding questions. Then, as I said, I will flip in the second half of the talk and start to talk about some results that we have that try to address some of these problems. So we have to start somewhere. So I hope this is not going to be a controversial starting point. This is the understanding that I would like to move on from. So if you think of the, first of all, the mean velocity, you have a wall here. This is drawn in terms of the pipe, center line out here. We have an outer length scale of R, the pipe radius. We have an inner length scale of mu or nu tau, the viscous unit. And a distance from the wall y, so y plus will denote scaling with respect to the viscous unit. And this is a fairly traditional look at division of that flow in terms of a linear sublayer, a buffer layer. So this is the inner scaling region, this is the outer scaling region. And the classical view says if the Reynolds number is high enough, so if you have sufficient separation of scales between the pipe radius r, or y on r and y plus, that ratio, the Kármán number, if the Kármán number is high enough, then there should be an overlap region where the dominant scale is just distance from the wall. Again, this is controversial, but for now, let's take that as sort of Occam's razor as being the simplest way that we can get to a scaling in this region. So I covered that, yes. So skin friction here. In the pipe, I'm sorry, friction velocity, skin friction over density. In the pipe, of course, we can get the skin friction reasonably well from the pressure gradient, and we can take many measurements down the fully developed region of the pipe and therefore eliminate individual errors on those tappings.
Pavel?
Yes.
Somewhat confused, is that a typo with the inner scaling up there and the outer scaling down there?
No. Inner scaling is this bit.
Oh.
Outer scaling is that bit.
Left and right.
Sorry. Yes. So it's, yeah, this way and that way. Thank you. We'll see as we go on that determining the skin friction is a limiting factor in most of these scaling hypotheses as we go forward. In the boundary layer, particularly, you really just can't get it accurately enough to, for example, determine the mean velocity scaling in this overlap region very convincingly. So we're going to work from a log law. So a local mean velocity divided by the friction velocity is 1 on the von Kármán constant, log of y plus plus a constant. Let's assume that that's where we're going to go from. And that's the physical space argument. So we have made some arguments, and I think it's increasingly clear that you could spend all your time working on this mean velocity profile, or you could take a broader view of turbulence and say any scaling arguments you make, any comments about a fully developed flow must apply in spectral space as well. And you can define some scales ranging from the viscous unit here, Kolmogorov length scale, Taylor length scale, a shear length scale given down here, distance from the wall, and radius. And this is on a scale of a wave number. I guess inverse wave number. You could think of these as beads on an abacus, and depending on where you are in this inhomogeneous wall flow, these beads will be in different locations relative to each other. So the difficulty of the wall-bounded flow then is that there is this on inhomogeneity, just to state the obvious. Where can we make the sort of scaling arguments that are commonly mentioned in the literature? So two that are of interest in the spectral space are a k to the minus 1 region, which sort of bounds this outer limit and has been observed, well, has been hypothesized to be observed close to the wall, and a k to the minus 5/3 in the traditional sense.
K minus 1 in horizontal wave number.
Yes, these are all streamwise wave numbers, yeah, kx. So you would expect to see this k to the minus 1 perhaps in the spanwise also, but not in the inhomogeneous direction.
Well, has that ever been observed in spanwise?
Sorry? I haven't seen it, but the arguments, I think, would hold for that, I believe.
Saduri, I think, observed it.
K to the minus 1?
Yes, papers in the early 90s, 94 by Saduri.
Saduri Veeramandi,
yeah. Veeramandi, yeah.
Those were streamwise spectra.
No, that's streamwise, not spanwise.
Not spanwise.
They didn't do spanwise. I think that's a pretty hard measurement to get at. Well, no, it wouldn't be, because it wouldn't be Y. No, you're right. You're right. No, that's my mistake. Sorry. So, no, you wouldn't see K1, K to the minus 1. Thank you, John. But one could again make some kind of overlap arguments. So starting from that point, what's new? Well, one of the questions that's really come up is, what is a high Reynolds number flow? When can we make these arguments? And one of the problems with that mean velocity scaling of the log law is the more measurements we make, the higher the Reynolds number is proposed to be required to see a true, in inverted commas, log law. So how high do we have to go to reach even the mean velocity, so the simplest sort of integrated global effect of a high Reynolds number? So related to that, and related to the previous slide, is the importance of scale separation. How far apart do these scales have to be before we can start to make some scaling arguments? What is the effect of finite Reynolds number? And that's increasingly important as the simulations come up in Reynolds number, but still aren't approaching where the experimentalists think you want to be in terms of a high Reynolds number. So I'll discuss a few of the new facilities. And accompanying this, as soon as you start to change that scale separation, either you need to be in a very big facility or you need to have a very small viscous scale in order to get that Kármán number up. So there are some challenges to the measurement techniques. The thing I'm going to focus on, as I mentioned, is the importance of the very large scales. So large and very large. Large scale here is hypothesized to correspond to the observations of packets of hairpin vortices. So these are of the order of 2 or 3 times the outer length scale, 2 to 3 delta or 2 to 3 pipe radii. The very large scale motions, so we'll call those VLSMs or superstructures, and that's just different terminology from different authors. The origin is really not known at this point, but these are things of the order of 10 times the pipe radius, a coherence in the streamwise direction of up to 10 times the outer length scale, so really long. And you'll see once we get into the surface layer, these are tens of kilometers long. So that raises a whole other slew of issues.
Channels, it's also seen in channels, only in pipes.
So pipes is 10, boundary layers is 6, and channels are a little less than 6. So depending on the flow that you look at, the actual dimensions of those are proposed to be slightly different, but they are proposed to have similar features. So internal flows and external flows are slightly different in terms of their extent, but they're a common feature to all those canonical flows. I'll show you there is a problem identifying the length based on whether these things are truly straight in the streamwise direction or whether they meander. And as soon as they meander off that one point measurement, then you could assume, you can realize that they're going to be much longer. But I'll show you my interpretation of that when we get to the end of the talk. But you know, this has been recognized for a long time, but 10 delta structures pose a lot of problems for convergence times and particularly for simulation box sizes. If you need to resolve something 10 delta long, the simulation box needs to be quite long. Structure and its origin, I won't have too much time to talk about that, but there are sort of two competing ideas here. One is from the school of the hairpin vortex. There are vortex regeneration mechanisms that lead you to structure in these wall-bounded flows. Sort of competing, it may be a case of people looking at the elephant, the blind men looking at the elephant from different positions, but at this point we'll call it a competing theory about instability and transient growth phenomena leading you to structure as well. Other things we've discussed are different models, attached eddy hypotheses, various other models of different aspects of wall turbulence, I mentioned universality. And roughness is becoming an increasingly important topic to consider, because as we go up in Reynolds number, the probability of getting a truly smooth wall flow, of course, becomes increasingly less. So even if you start out with a very smooth submarine, for example, by the time you've had some, been out in the water and you have some biofouling, you're up to a rough wall flow pretty quickly. It's interesting from the point of view of introducing another length scale into the problem as well. So these are some of the things that the community has been looking at, or at least some of the people I've been interacting have been looking at. So let me focus really on these top two points. So how do we get to these very high Reynolds numbers, to get to this situation of having a scale separation? The work that I was involved with as a graduate student was in the Princeton superpipe. So in that case, it's a pipe with a pumping facility, so you can run at a pressure of up to 200 times atmospheric pressure. So you modify nu in the Kármán, in the Reynolds number. So the highest Kármán number there is 300,000. This is a plot just sort of listing some of the facilities that we were compared data in our Physics of Fluids paper. And some interesting data here. This is the Y plus for the start of the log law observed in the facility. So from the superpipe, 600, 100, 200, quite a big difference. Okay. The other...
All pipes.
Sorry?
All pipes.
Nope. So pipe, here we are. Pipe, channel, right. boundary layer. An important column here is number of decades of the log law. So working from this nominal Y plus start, how many decades of log law do you actually see? And you can see that the best that we really do is below two. Okay, so with you have to ask yourself how, you know, what do you need in order to determine this sort of scaling? And you need at least one decade of anything. So we're sort of there. It's a challenge. So in the this is another one I want to point out to you. SL test is the surface layer test. Surface layer turbulence and environmental science test site. So that's basically the atmospheric surface layer, and I'll show you a little bit about that later. So the RE tau, delta plus, is of the order of 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. And nominally, you get three decades of log law out there. But of course,
the dots here, which means that they did not observe the log law.
Yeah, so the problem is how do you get your shear stress, right? So you get a nice big boundary layer, but you can't get the shear stress very accurately anyway. And there are people have made efforts to do that, but again, is that sufficient to go in and make an argument about the mean velocity profile? And it probably isn't. There's one notable exception to that. There's work by Andreas et al. Where they just looked at the slope change going through near neutral thermal stability, and they show some changes. It's a consistent study, self-consistent study. And then the methods that we're using to get U tau and measuring. So we're still really working with pitots and hot wires. So how do we get to high Reynolds number? Well, we either take delta up. So here's an image of that SL test site. So this is an experiment that I worked on with 31 single normal hot wires. So flow is from right to left coming in. And we made some synchronous measurements with logarithmically spaced wires. And then in the background, you see some work from the Melbourne group with sonic anemometers in a spanwise and wall normal array. This is one effort here to get the shear stress. That's a flush-mounted shear stress plate. There were some difficulties with that in this particular experiment, but there's some other work that's come out of that since. So you can either go big, the surface layer, the equivalent delta from that is of the order of 50 to 100 meters at this test site, pretty reliably, or you can go small. So the Princeton superpipe, Lex Smits, has been developing this nanoprobe, NSTAP. I forget what that stands for. Nanoscale thermal anemometry probe, that's right. So the scale here is 20 microns. So as the viscous scale goes down, as you pump up the pipe, you need a smaller and smaller probe in order to avoid the resolution issues associated with the wire. So they've fabricated this nanoscale probe, and they've got some really nice results coming out from that now. But it's not easy. Both of those have their problems. So let me tell you a little bit more about the SL test site, because what you'll see as we go on is that we have a bunch of data from the high Reynolds number laboratory facilities. And then the trends tend to be extrapolated by sticking the surface layer point on the end. So you have some data here, this is the Reynolds number scale, data here, and then a point from the surface layer. Let me tell you a little bit more about this setup. Advantages, very high Reynolds number, large scales, it's free. This particular site has a 100-kilometer fetch coming into the measurement site, which is here, but the whole test site, this is out in the Utah Salt Flats, just a couple of hours west of Salt Lake City. The whole thing is greater than 200 kilometers. The height change is pretty low coming into the test site. And if you go out just at the end of the winter rains, basically, as the surface is drying, it's reasonably smooth. You have to balance the surface drying and getting dusty and cracking with the plier not being sufficiently firm for you to mount your equipment on. So if you sort of get there too early, the thing sinks into the crust. If you get there too late, it's a rough surface.
It's about the months in spring, then that's all?
Pretty much. Yeah, well, it depends what you want. If you want a rough surface, then you just stay there through the summer, right? And you get all the different conditions as you go along. But usually,
two-phase flow.
Well, that's right. So you know, it's all there. It just depends whether you really want one in particular. Otherwise, you can always get some sort of data. So these are the data that I'm going to show were from May of 2005, and that was a reasonably good time. Although you'll see that the data are still have an equivalent sand grain roughness of the order of 25 viscous units. So you at 5 meters up here in this case is about 5 meters a second, and delta plus is about 10 to the 6. The obvious disadvantages are boundary conditions. It's really hard to operate out there. It's really, really hot, and it's pretty difficult atmospheric conditions. And then the obvious one, this is a thermal layer, so we have to try and pick the point where we're going through near thermally neutral and assume that that's okay, even when we're developing these very long structures upstream coming down. So the data I'll show are reasonably strict, so the ratio of the height to the Mononobikoff length is less than 0.01. And you'll see on this next slide, so here's Z on L, the time, this is the evening transition. Here's sunset from one day, and you can see that Z on L is low.
What's on this axis, on the vertical?
Z on L, so the height. With apologies, I'm going to be using Z and Y as distance from the wall, depending on which slope.
Z is what, thermal?
Sorry? So Z is distance from the wall, distance from the ground, and L is the Mononobikoff length. Okay. So this is the indication of whether this is or how thermal this boundary layer is.
It's a characteristic of thermal stratification.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So we want to minimize this effect. So we're going to operate in this window here, and here's a blow up of that. This is noise, but you can see that within this quarter of an hour period, maybe half an hour, no, quarter of an hour period, you can say that we're very, very close to thermally neutral. But it is a transition. And the problem associated with that only being quarter of an hour is getting converged data now is almost impossible. So it's a trade-off. Do we go for relaxing that thermal condition, or do we go for, so I'm taking longer data, or we're talking too fast, taking longer data sets, or do we go for a strict thermal condition and just take shorter runs? So we went for the latter case, just so we knew exactly where we were in viscous units, or as best we could. And the data that you get look quite like some laboratory flows. So here's some different years. This is our data set corresponding to a K plus of between 25 and 50. That's the mean profiles, and this is the turbulence intensity. So here are the data from our data set. These are laboratory sets here. So you get a long way out in Z plus, but you lose the near wall peak, probably because the surface is rough at this point.
You lose the peak when you increase Reynolds? No.
Yes, because the surface is rough.
Ah, those see? They really go down, right.
Yeah. See that? Yeah. And so the first probe as well, I should say, is of the order of a millimeter from the surface, right? So, I mean, this is tough. These are tough data points to get down here. But these ones are consistent. This is a Marusik attached eddy hypothesis for the line of where those data should be. So we're within the bounds of that. So the point of showing you this is basically to say that we believe that the surface layer is a good model for the trends of the very high Reynolds number data.
You've never seen this flattening really going into something flat.
Where? Here? Where?
I mean, there is not a single set of data in which you would say that your U prime square, U prime would flatten, no?
That's a loaded question, because there's a big discussion about whether
this is
a plateau or a peak. Okay, so public opinion has changed on that. So for the superpipe data, there were some probe resolution effects that came in.
It's an inner variables, right? Yeah.
It's an inner variables. Yeah. What I will show you is that this peak slash plateau slash region is strongly influenced by these very large scale motions. So that is going to rise, we agree with that. If the very large scale motions become completely dominant, then you would expect this to be sort of the plateau that increases as you go up in Reynolds number. So how high do we need to go in Reynolds number? I'm talking too much, so I just say that from the mean velocity it looks like an R plus of about 5,000. From a separation of scales based on these very large scale motions in the near wall cycle, the Melbourne group suggested about 4,000. By thinking about small scale scale separation, we get to 5,000 as well. So something of the, and that's sort of the absolute lowest. So if you want decades of overlap, we're talking about 10 to the 4 in R plus.
It's on the previous slide. It's somehow, This one.
Mm-hmm.
What bothers me, it's not a pipe, I mean, this is a boundary. Why it goes down when you go away?
So this is about 0.1 of the boundary layer thickness.
Ah, you already approached the boundary layer thickness.
Yeah, so
boundary layer thickness.
Of course.
Is that high?
So at this site, it's given to be between, by repeated measurements, it's between 50 and 100 meters. The equivalent delta. Now you get that by looking at velocity profiles and putting together a lot of information basically from telesons, and we didn't actually have that for this data set, but the inference is that this would be at the least 5% of the boundary layer, probably more like 10% of the boundary layer. So that's consistent with what you would expect to see even in this boundary layer.
And other Reynolds numbers also that is going down.
Yeah, so you could expect to come down here to whatever the free stream velocity, free stream turbulence intensity is. Now the question is, what do you expect in the surface layer? Well, we haven't got that far, haven't got out that far to know. But I suspect there are people in the room that could answer that. Let's get to thinking about structure and statistics. So I think our view at the moment would be that let's start at the bottom. So we have the small scales, and we know quite a bit about those, and we've known quite a bit about those from simulation and from the lower Reynolds number experiments. We know there's some near wall activity, and it seems to be remarkably robust as you increase the Reynolds number. So for example, Kaluki et al. Have some work where they looked at the streak spacing in the surface layer and were able to show that it was very similar to identical to what you would see in the laboratory. So those two we understand a little bit about. A large scale motion, so this idea, I'll work from Adrian's ideas here of a hairpin vortex packet. So you have an individual hairpin vortex, they seem to be aligned in packets, and there seem to be packets that move faster than other ones of different sizes. There's been some work looking at the constant momentum zones that seem to be induced between the legs of these hairpin vortices. And a lot of the work on these structures has been performed necessarily in the lower Reynolds number laboratory flows. There's an interesting question about what you would expect to see in terms of this structure when you get to the surface layer. Now, in the low Reynolds number flows, these things can span pretty much up to the outer length scale, so up to the boundary layer thickness in some of the classical work. Do we really expect to see hairpins that are 100 meters tall in the surface layer? It's an interesting question. We don't know the scaling. So some of the scaling has been proposed to be on outer variables. It seems unlikely that that's true in this something as high Reynolds number as the surface layer. And in fact, some efforts at that test site to go and to do some PIV diagnostic and examine looking for the swirling field to see if you see the heads of hairpins has come up short, and you really don't see them close to the wall.
Can I ask you about that? So I think when you have such a large range of scales, if you look at the small, like the entropy or something really characteristic of the small scale, it's going to be very difficult to see structures like this.
Mm-hmm.
Have those data you mentioned, have they been looked at bigger scales? In other words, for example, you could think of pre-filtering them at some larger scale mm-hmm. to see whether you see these structures.
So this is the work of Scott. name just escaped me. At Notre Dame. Sorry, I'll come back.
Morris?
Scott Morris, thank you. Yeah. I don't believe they've filtered it in that sense. Our argument is actually the opposite, that their graining may have been too coarse to capture these hairpin heads. So it depends what you want to. Where are you starting from? Are you expecting these things to be big, or are you expecting them to be a forest that there to be many more of these things, and therefore that they're smaller than what we're expecting from the laboratory? So I think we need to go back and.
I guess would be that it would actually be quite important to pre-filter to really see them, because otherwise you have a collection of such small-scale stuff that's going to be very difficult to identify large-scale structures otherwise.
Yes. As I said, my interpretation of their PIV data is that actually their field of view may have been so big that even with that pre-filter, their spacing, velocity spacing, we're only giving them a few points. So, I think we'd like to go back and test this. So, we have an idea that these are not inner scaling out there, and I'll hopefully, if I actually get through my slides, I'll actually get to show you that we can see that these are attached to the wall in even in a high Reynolds number flow, and therefore we would expect them to be a little smaller. But it's an open question, absolutely. So the question is, how do you go from something that spans the boundary layer thickness in the laboratory to what will you see in something that is so much higher in Reynolds number? I'm going to focus on the very large scale. So here is some work from Monti et al. This is in a pipe. They have a rake of hot wires over some segment of the pipe, all at the same distance from the wall. They take a reasonably long data sample, then they reconstruct what the spatial field would look like. This is streamwise velocity, using the local mean velocity as the convection velocity, so Taylor's hypothesis. And the blue is velocity below the local mean, and red is above. So this comes to your question about the length. So for a coherent piece in line with one probe, it's at the order of 10 pipe radii. But if you follow this one here, you can easily see that you could easily say it would be 20 radii or longer. So the question is
regional flow velocity, like a kind of streak like this.
Right. So this is further from the wall. This is 0.1 radii from the wall. It's a reasonable Reynolds number in delta plus. So it's not the near wall cycle. It's above that.
But we don't know if it extends further from the wall.
I'll show you that later, hopefully soon, and I think it's the next slide. It's something different to the near wall cycle. It does scale on outer variables. So you'll see in the spectra that it comes out at about 10 radii in the pipe. But the question here is this all one structure that meanders across the measurement plane, or is it an assembly of several different structures and a trick of the eye that you think this is all one? So questions about this is, where do they come from? People have thought maybe they're facility dependent, are there large-scale slow fluctuations associated with the pump in a wind tunnel or in the pipe? The time scales of these things can be really long, and these things can be up to the fully developed test section length in some of these flows as well. I'll show you, I hope, that this is a robust feature and really doesn't seem to be something that's induced in the flow by external sort of non-desired factors. This question of the extent and the question of evolution size and how fast they travel. So, introduction to the VLSMs. And this has been known for many years. So these long correlation tails, known from Favre from 67, correlations in the wall normal direction, so answering your question. Long correlations in the streamwise direction, but over a significant wall normal period height from Kovasny et al. The recent work has shown several distinct properties. So here is a pre-multiplied power spectrum from the streamwise velocity, so K, phi of K, and this is KY, so this wave number normalized by distance from the wall. This is all at the outside edge of the our assumed log region, overlap region. And red to yellow is increasing Reynolds number. These are pipe flow data. And you can see that there's increasing energetic content here. So in pre-multiplied coordinates on a log scale, equal area under this curve corresponds to equal energy. So
it's no one over K spectrum at large Reynolds number.
I'm sorry?
It's no one over K spectrum at large Reynolds number.
That's another loaded question, but we're a long way. We're a long way from the wall. So you would this was hypothesized to be destroying the K to the minus one region. But if you are close enough to the wall, the energetic contribution here is less. So you would start to see a K to the minus one here. But this is in this exactly right. In this scaling, you would expect it to be a flat line. Yeah. So this far from the wall, no. And the reason is that this energetic content for the DLSM goes up. So this is the 10 delta scale here. So as you go up in the Reynolds number, it's increasingly energetic in the streamwise velocity. And the other interesting point here that Gwala and Adrian showed is that it's active. So in the terms of Townsend's active or inactive motion, these very large scales would have been expected to be inactive, to just be a large scale sloshing down close to the wall, so more like a modulation of the mean velocity. But actually, so here's wavelength over radius, and here's contribution to the shear stress. So you can see that these very large scales, here defined as being 3, but if you go up to 6 radii, these very large scales contribute at least a third of the shear stress.
How do you read this figure?
So this is wavelength normalized with the pipe radius. Okay. This is contribution to the shear stress, so a fractional
contribution.
The larger
wavelength, the larger the contribution.
Yeah. Well, so it's saying anything above this line is contributing at least a third of the shear stress. So they must be considered to be active. And then the last one, again, it's been known for a while, but the community sort of come back to it, is if you decompose a signal at, say, this height, 10% of the bound of the pipe radius, and you take one signal and you filter it, so you do a low-pass filter shown in blue, and you do a high-pass filter shown in red, there's an amplitude modulation effect. So when you have a large-scale velocity excursion at this height, you have increased small-scale activity, and then you have reduced small-scale activity during the large-scale negative excursion. So there's some nonlinear effect, some amplitude modulation effect, and I'll talk to that a little bit more.
This large-scale motion doesn't suppress turbulence, it actually enhances it.
I would say it enhances it here and suppresses it here relative.
Yeah, right? It suppresses it when the slashical motion amplitude is less.
It's negative here at this height. But what I'm going to show you is that modulation effect reverses as you go away from the wall.
Okay.
So it's a very complex effect. And the Melbourne group has made quite a bit of progress looking at this in particular. So just to show you where this spectral activity is, this is from the work of Hutchins and Marusik in a laboratory. This is distance from the wall, this should say Y plus or Z plus, and this is the wavelength normalized on inner units. So this is the near wall cycle. This is corresponds to why you get the near wall peak in intensity. This second region, or second maximum out here, so this is the cartoon, here's the near wall cycle, here's the second maximum, corresponds to where this large scale activity occurs. And you can see that it's seated somewhere further out from the wall, and it spans some region in wavelength that's centered on about 6 to 10 times the outer length scale. This is the equivalent plot from the surface layer. So again, we talked about the near wall peak being suppressed, but you can see that there's still large-scale activity going on out here, too. And this has implications for the scaling of the streamwise fluctuations, per your questions on the earlier slide. This is some work, again, from Hutchins and Marusik. So this is the plot I showed you before. They took this spectrum, applied a filter here, and looked at the different contributions below that line, so smaller wavelength and larger wavelength, compared to the integrated effect. So this top line here is the in this particular boundary layer, the distribution of the streamwise turbulence intensity. And this isn't reproducing very well, but this line here is the small scale activity, and this one here is the large scale activity. So if you sum those two lines, you get the top one, but you can see that the large scale activity is centered out here, and there is some contribution out here too. So if this line corresponds to the inner scaling activity, this corresponds to the very large scales that do not scale on inner variables, then we have one explanation when you sum these two for why this inner peak doesn't scale on inner variables, because there's some outer contribution. Question?
Good question, yeah. If there would be a lock layer, where would the lock layer be sitting between these two activity regions?
Ah, yes. So the Melbourne group...
It seems like a plateau.
Plateau peak, yeah. People have... the Melbourne group have hypothesized that this large-scale activity is centered in the log layer. And it does seem to... I will address this also again if I actually can stop spending so long on these slides. But yeah, you can see, so this is about 10 to the 4, it's 7,300, I think, this Reynolds number. So this is the peak here. The circle corresponds to the peak, and that's right in the log layer.
There is some arbitrariness in this separation. You can
separate. Oh, you could do it anywhere. So you have to have an argument for it. So their argument was that it separates this region and that region.
So red is the separation layer.
Red is the separation. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Not much.
So, you know, again, if you had a much higher scale separation, these two would be much further apart, and you could, you know, make an even stronger distinction between the two. Okay, where does this VLSM peak sit? So I'm going to now go into these sort of spectra and pick out the Y location of this maximum. In the pipe, I did this for some of the superpipe data, and here's R plus and Y plus of the peak going up here. And this is the equivalent for the boundary layer from the work of Mathis et al. And as I summarize here, so it doesn't scale on Y plus, and it doesn't scale on Y.
The position of the peak is a function of what? Of Reynolds of the pipe?
Of Kármán number, so Reynolds number here. So this is Y plus of the peak versus Reynolds number in the form of the Kármán number. So it doesn't collapse with Y plus, and it doesn't collapse with Y on R either, out of scaling. This is a data trend, and I'll come back to why I've put this particular interpretation on this plot later. Boundary layer, the same sort of thing. Now, this is the plot I alluded to earlier. Here are laboratory data, and you can see you could fit several different lines to this. These are two data points from the surface layer from two different groups. And you may say, why is there such a large scatter? Well, this is our data point with measurements coming up from the surface, so there's 31 single normal hot wires. This is the data point from the Melbourne group coming down. So they're using sonic anemometers, and their lowest measurement location is 1 meter. So we're coming to the region of importance from the different ends. And I will show you that I believe they're actually both legitimate data points. One last thing to note is resolution effects do probably play an effect on that last point from the pipe. So again, it's not an inner scaling phenomenon, the location of these VLSM peaks, and it's not an outer scaling. But as you go up in Reynolds number in physical space, so in Y, you know, in the pipe, we fix the outer scale. As you go up in Reynolds number in physical space, this effect moves nearer to the wall. Okay, so let me show you a little bit more about this modulation effect. So this is a synchronous record from the surface layer, from the first 5 meters of the surface layer. So this is time, this is distance from the wall. We have these 31 wires, and we've interpolated between them. We put a sliding window on here of 10 seconds, just to give you a sort of local mean, if you like, or a large scale velocity signal. This is the small scale, corresponding small scale activity.
So the color means the velocity in the streamwise direction.
Streamwise, so this is high and low. But what you can see is these very large coherent regions. So this is high speed, and this one is low speed, sort of across this, even across this 5 meters in the surface layer. And there's some correlation between the large scale activity
and the small scale. You can measure time in units of space multiplied by mean velocity.
Yes, but there's a problem with that. But there's a problem with that, because look at the coherence here, and what velocity do you use? And so we've actually done this deliberately, and we fought some reviewers on this, because you make an assumption, and that assumption, this should be shown not to be valid for these very large scales. That's where Taylor's hypothesis will fail. So this just shows you really the amplitude modulation effect. So you can see during this large scale positive excursion across the layer, you see a small scale enhanced activity region here. Okay, and then vice versa in the slow region.
So when it moves faster near the wall, then there is more turbulence. That makes sense.
Faster near the wall, more turbulence. So that goes back to this slide, right? But when you go up away from the wall, you can see that that's not correct, and that's not true. You get this reversal.
People don't measure correlation functions with two probes?
Not in the surface layer. You mean? Oh, separate like that. We haven't done that in the surface layer, no.
Is it too hard?
Yeah. You could. What you have to do is go out to this site with one objective in mind, because you know this is 2 weeks worth of work to get a single good data set. You could do it. We've done in the laboratory. We've actually been using some timers off PRV to get at some of these questions as well, but again, very low Reynolds number. This is just showing that same phenomenon. This idea of an amplitude modulation has been explored in the past by Bandiopadha and Hussain. Mathis et al., the Melbourne group, have looked at using a Hilbert decomposition. So you have a carrier wave and a modulating wave, and then you extract the envelope of the modulated signal. So EL is the envelope, UL is the large scale carrier signal here. And you look at the correlation between the two. So that basically tells you the sign of the amplitude modulation. So it's positive, close to the wall, passes through zero in this range of Reynolds numbers within this region here, becomes negative, and then this is what happens when you reach the edge of the boundary layer. So this modulation, as we were saying before, is positive, close to the wall, reverses sign somewhere close to the logarithmic region as you move away from the wall. The Melbourne group has done quite a lot of work at looking at this, and they've been able to extrapolate this into a model that allows them to predict the streamwise turbulence intensity at different Reynolds numbers in a recent science paper. I won't go into that here, but this is a very promising way of understanding this phenomenon. What do these modes look like? So now we've done, with a single probe, we've gone into to look at the correlations. And if you take a reference point at 120 viscous units and you look at the correlation, you see what you would expect from a laboratory. So an inclination of the order of 10 degrees here as you go up in distance from the wall. But you see something pretty interesting if you take a reference point further from the wall. So this is at 4,000. The red box here is the area covered in this plot. But if you take this reference point off wall here, you can see that the 10-11 degree slope doesn't really describe what's going on. There's something with a lot less phase variation in the wall normal direction. And I'll show you that that's consistent with lower Reynolds number studies and with our little model. Let me keep going. So here is an LES study conditioned on a large-scale negative velocity excursion at the wall. So there's some similarity between this shape and what you saw on the previous slide. But if you take that condition point off wall, you start to see the same sort of thing that you saw before. Putting it all together. So I've told you a little bit about the very large-scale motions, a little bit about the hairpins. I haven't mentioned this too much, but we've talked a little bit about this spectral shape, so near wall cycle and the large scales. So I would argue, and I think very few would argue with me about this, that any model that truly understands what's going on in wall turbulence needs to unify all of these things. So it's no use tackling just the statistics or just the structures. You need to be able to unite all of these views. So I'll spend the remaining minutes of my talk just trying to show you some of the things we've been doing to incrementally move forward in terms of identifying structure, statistics, and some of these large scales. So total change of gear. We're going to work in a pipe with a full turbulence field. We're going to project onto a divergence-free basis and consider propagating modes with a streamwise wave number and azimuthal wave, streamwise wave number K, azimuthal wave number N, and temporal frequency omega. And if we write this decomposition out and we identify the 0,0,0 modes as the turbulent mean profile, which they must be, we'll use experimental data from the superpipe. And we have these two equations for the mean and for the fluctuations. So I'm going to focus on the fluctuations here. But at this point, all we've done is just write a decomposition in Navier-Stokes. So there's no modeling here at all. If we put in all the modes, we would recover the mean profile, the 0,0,0 modes from here that appear in this linear operator L. So in some sense, it's a linearization approach, except I'm explicitly retaining that forcing term F. So if we rewrite this in the form of a transfer function, so at a given wave number frequency combination, we have a forcing F that's internal to the flow, all the nonlinear terms are put together there. We have a response V that's governed by this transfer function, where L is that linear operator specific to the kn omega. This is called the resolvent. If we look at the form of the resolvent, you see that for a large Reynolds number in the turbulent case, you'll get a large response when the local mean velocity u is equal to the convective velocity of this disturbance, omega on k. So this is really heading towards critical layer theory from the linearly unstable flow scenario. So we decompose this operator using a Schmidt decomposition, effectively a singular value decomposition at each k and omega. And we say if this operator is low rank, then this first singular mode, the first singular value will be large. Therefore, we would expect this mode shape, the first mode shape, to dominate what we would see in the spectrum at this k, n, and omega. So this is a pseudo-spectral rather than a spectral interpretation. This is not a linearly unstable flow. This is a forced flow. So there is an analogy to Orr-Sommerfeld equations, and we get a large response here, as I said, at the critical layer, where the local mean velocity is equal to the phase velocity of the disturbance, and near the wall. And the two solutions from linear stability theory give you either distinct critical and wall layers, or a critical layer that overlaps with the wall layer. So if you focus for a little while on this lower branch solution, you can see perhaps where I'm heading in terms of that amplitude modulation effect that I discussed earlier, that any mode corresponding to the critical layer that has a footprint at the wall must have a response in terms of the wall layer. And if you think about this across many scales, there's a natural link between something that's going on above the wall and what's going on closer to the wall. So this has been proposed before, or an aspect of it has been proposed before. Srinivasan discussed critical layers in turbulent flow, and Sirovich discussed propagating flows in a general critical layer sense. Srinivasan showed that the Reynolds stress scaled with R plus to the half, and that's one of the scaling that pops out for the lower branch in the pipe. So a wall layer would be centered on R plus to the half, and the critical layer centered on R plus to the 2/3. That's just the asymptotic result from this lower branch scaling. So let's take a look at those first singular modes that pop out. And I'm going to focus on the wave number pair corresponding to these VLSM. So now this is non-dimensionalized with respect to pipe radius. So this is the kr of 1 and n of 10. And as you increase omega, you see, as you would expect, that the energy in the cross section moves away from the wall, moves away slowly. This is a doubling of the frequency, and this is a tripling of the frequency. So it moves away slowly, and then faster. And if I actually plot that up, so distance from the wall, this is the turbulent mean profile at two Reynolds numbers in the dotted line, and so this is mean velocity divided by the centerline velocity for these dotted lines, and then the phase velocity divided by the centerline velocity. And I'm plotting where the maximum associated with each phase velocity sits in the pipe. So as you increase the phase velocity, you have a response that's dominated by the wall layer, and then out here it's dominated by the critical layer. So the phase velocity is equal to the local mean velocity here. And from looking at these two, I've lost the label, so this is a doubling of Reynolds number. As you increase in Reynolds number, that transition between a wall layer and a critical layer response happens always at 2/3 times the centerline velocity. So that's where the intersection with the local mean velocity sits for this wave number combination. So we'll work with that, and I'm going to show you the mode shapes associated with k of 1, n of 10, and this 2/3 times the centerline velocity. This is a helical mode in the pipe, so u and w are related. This thing is going down the pipe, but v has a very different shape. Okay, so v does not have that phase variation in the wall normal direction, but the u one hopefully looks similar to the correlation plots that I showed you from the surface layer. And in fact, this is what I was aiming at. So here's a similar type shape, and this was from the LES in the channel. So boundary layer, channel, and pipe. This seems to be representative of the shape of the mode that's corresponding to these very large scales. So we can go a little further if we assume that there's something special about that intersection between the wall modes and the critical modes. And so if the phase velocity of 2/3 times the centerline velocity is important, we can say that at the critical point, the local mean velocity is equal to 2/3 times the centerline velocity. And that tells us that the peak energy associated with this particular VLSM-like mode should scale with r plus to the 2/3. So if I plot the data from the superpipe pre-multiplied by r plus to the minus 2/3, here's our prediction in the dashed line. And these are the data points that I showed you before. So we only have 5 points. 3 are great. 1 has spatial resolution, and 1 I don't know what's going on. So you could say this is worthy of further study at this point. So this is the plot I showed you before. So here's the pipe data and the r plus to the 2/3 line. In the boundary layer, r plus to the 2/3 is this dashed line. And the agreement is not so good. R plus to the half, however, hits exactly on through this surface layer, one of the surface layer points, and does reasonably well on the laboratory data. So we would say then that this would be the wall layer scaling from the critical model. And if we consider the other branch of the solution, you can see that it goes right through the other point. So I would argue that there actually, as you go up in scale separation, there's the potential to see both branches. I mentioned this issue of whether this is a single coherent structure or a trick of the eye. If I take left and right going waves and superpose them, I end up with this lozenge type structure of slow and fast velocity relative to the mean. So here's what the unwrapped surface would look like at a distance of 0.1 radii from the wall. If I add in two other modes, very quickly I start to get this complicated pattern. And if you started to follow one of these ones here, it's just a simple addition of modes, you very rapidly get up to something of 20 times the pipe radius. So I would argue that this meandering effect is really a trick of the eye, and it's a superposition of many modes. Last point is you can also get structure out of this model. So if I take one of these wall modes now, so a lower wavelength, and I look for swirl, so the imaginary part of the eigenvalue associated with the velocity tensor, I can regenerate this picture. So this is the swirl pattern associated with the wall mode. So this is streamwise direction, unwrapped azimuthal direction. And blue is rotation in the traditional sense of the hairpin vortices, so flow is in this direction. And red is the retrograde sense, so the sense you don't expect to see so much. Thank you. So our model is a periodic, and you expect to see rotation of both senses. If you add in the mean shear, this measure, I mean, this is one of the other sort of outstanding questions of how you identify structure in the flow. And the big search has been to find measures that are not affected by the mean shear. This is still affected by the mean shear through this term here. If I add a mean velocity profile reminiscent of the turbulent mean to this mode, I end up with just individual hairpins, a forest of individual hairpins of one sense of rotation. So we suppress the retrograde vortices, enhance the prograde ones. So if you were to sum many of these wall modes, you would very quickly end up with an apparent hairpin packet. If they have different convection velocities relative to each other, they will appear to grow and decay. So there is a basis here to understand both the statistical content of wall turbulence and the structural one as well. So this is ongoing work. Let me go back. So with this idea, what we're basically saying is the Navier-Stokes operator is a very directional amplifier. So if I start from the mean velocity profile, I can regenerate some of the statistical features, or hopefully all of them, if I put enough modes in, all of the statistical features and the structural features. If I had the right assembly of modes, I would have the right forcing, which would feed back to give you the mean velocity profile, which then completes that loop. So mean velocity feeds to the fluctuations, which gives you the forcing, which gives you the mean velocity, which is what, of course, we all want. I can, in this model, I've jumped in between the forcing and the mean velocity and said I'm going to assume the mean velocity. We've also done some work where we've said, okay, let's just put in a zero mean, a Gaussian noise into a two-dimensional three-component model. And we've had some success using the directionality of the Navier-Stokes operator to regenerate that mean profile. So since I'm running out of time, let me just show you a comparison of the results here. So this is in Couette flow. The solid line is the DNS results of Sukahara et al. And the symbols here are the results that we get from our model. So just amplifying from this white noise, getting back to something that looks like the mean velocity profile. So we're able to interrupt this cycle at different points and regenerate aspects of wall turbulence. So let me finish there. I focused on one more recent realization in wall turbulence, that the very large scale motions are increasingly dominant as the Reynolds number increases. I didn't have too much time to discuss the scaling, small scale energy close to the wall, but I talked about the modulation effects. And then I spent a little bit of time talking about our attempt to try and unite the statistical aspects, the structural aspects, and use what we know a little bit about the Navier-Stokes operator. And this idea of propagating modes in turbulence is a little bit counter to what we expect in some aspects, but I think we've been able to show that if you think about the dominant modes and a low-rank operator, they certainly reproduce some of the things, some of the features that we see in wall turbulence. So with that, I'll finish. And thank you for your time and talk.
This linear model, these sort of elongated structures you observe, but you say are not as long, and that what's the streamwise vorticity distribution associated with those structures?
I think I have a slide with that. No, I took it down. The streamwise vorticity is basically a scaled up version of what you would expect from the near wall cycle.
Okay, so they're streamwise.
Yeah. So they're weak. And so Ivan has shown this from DNS, from one of Javier's DNS in the channel. And they've gone in. So in this sense, it's just weak, large rolls that pick up away from the wall. So that's exactly consistent with the plots that we were showing, that if you superpose left and right going waves, that's what you end up with.
I guess my point earlier was the following, that when you look at isovelocity contours in real turbulence, because velocity is dominated by large scales anyway, it's easy for the eye to pick this up.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at vorticity, it's very difficult. It's
absolutely. Yeah, you'll lose this altogether.
You lose it, but it doesn't mean it's not there. If you were to filter at that scale, suddenly the eye might pick up.
And I agree with that, but my counter would be that this comes from one of those wall modes. So this is the type of mode that sits in this region. So you get the structure from one of these ones that's attached to the wall. So you would expect to see these things close to the wall and going up. So I think, if I might be so bold, that both of us are correct in the sense that you would expect to see them both bigger and smaller. But with that particular PIV, it's so coarse that if you were trying to see these things down close to the wall, you wouldn't get them. But you're exactly right that you need to pick what you're looking for ever so carefully. And I think the other thing we've shown here is that the mean shear is still really important with all of the measures that we use for detecting these structures.
It's another, I don't know, some kind of equation. Your separation of this large scale and small scale turbulence was purely special. In a sense, you just this red line, you say, okay, this is this wavelength, this is this wavelength. Is there any way to introduce any temporal? Because one is kind of long linear motion, and all the small fluctuation are fast fluctuating. But in a closed, case, we always give easy to have vortex, which is average of a few rotation periods, and that's it. I mean, all the small turbulence done, we see our structure.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any temporal separation?
Well, I think
separation?
You hit on one really big point that I didn't address here. So this is with Taylor's hypothesis to get to a wavelength. Okay.
So actually, you have temporal measurement and you
Right. So these are almost always hot wire measurements. So this one has already been used Taylor's hypothesis. Some of the data that I showed, that's why I've stayed in temporal space, so I didn't have to do that. The other thing that's really important is you can see the footprint of these large scales reaches all the way down to the wall. So that's why it affects this this peak. Okay. So there must be some way.
But you have simultaneous measurements at different heights, right?
We have simultaneous.
You have simultaneous measurements at different heights. Not span wise, but at least. So you can actually use space and time.
Yeah. So we are actually in the process of doing a
direction by Taylor, but you can use.
That's right. And so we're actually just about to submit a paper with a wavelet analysis of this data that actually starts to think about that. Oh, in fact, I think we submitted it. That actually starts to try and use more dimensions to get at these structures. But the issue that Charles raised is really important, is that it may span this whole region, but you have to do some conditional averaging or something to strengthen your signal because it's weak by the time it's down here, but it's non-negligible because, as I said, it modulates the small scale. So.
It's this simple picture that you have something large and something small, so you want to filter this out and look at what is this. But it's something which actually both large and small simultaneously. I mean, it's also important. But temporally it's different because it's something which is probably coherent in some properly chosen reference frame. It's a long living object.
Yeah.
So it's maybe, that's why I'm kind of, I don't have any clear idea here. But I have a feeling that best by looking at temporal properties, you can better identify than by just trying to filter small scale and large scale in mean space. But it may have kind of, could be sharp here.
So that's, yeah, so when we did this filtering, we did it in temporal space, but it's still not clear cut, right? And particularly when you don't have a big separation of these two peaks.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not simple, but even with it not being simple, we have a clear idea of the link between the large scale and the small scale.
Those are best available rate of snap.
That's right, yeah, we're not going to get higher, and it's hard to get between the lab and the surface layer.
Okay. Well, yes.
So you mentioned about the Taylor hypothesis. So what's the mean velocity they use? You just use a particular.
So this paper uses the local mean. Okay. So I would agree with that here because I've argued that this is a critical mode. So I agree with this here. I would say that out here we're extremely this plot extremely underestimates the local mean velocity. And I'm sorry. You've used an underestimate of the appropriate velocity for that structure. And out here, you've used an overestimate, because I'm saying that this footprint here, it all corresponds to one convection velocity. And that's actually consistent with studies of Taylor's hypothesis. And as I've mentioned, we've been doing some time-resolved PIV to actually measure the Kn omega spectrum, or the equivalent of that in the boundary layer, and that's what we see. So as you go to large scale, the convection velocity exceeds the local mean in close to the wall, and it's lower than the local mean out further from the wall.
So, in a way, Taylor works a lot.
Taylor works really well down here. It's known to fail for these very large-scale structures because the turbulence is no longer frozen. I mean, that's the fundamental violation.
Is there any possibility to have probes, along?
For this question, yeah.
No, I mean, this direction is.
No, the question was, can you do them in space? Yeah.
Space, right? If it's hard to put one in the wake of the other.
Yes.
The problem.
Yeah.
So, but optical is good. Yeah.
And, you could, yeah, exactly. But you could do it with some spanwise offset, but you need to know what that is a priori. I mean, it's a little tricky. So the Melbourne group did exactly that. That's how they got to that spanwise spacing of these things in the surface layer. Yeah. But yeah, it would be interesting to do that, and we'd be looking at that. So the work of Morrison and Bullock a long time ago did exactly that to get at this Kn or K omega spectrum, and we've used PIV to be the equivalent.
Okay. So, thanks again. Thank you.